Show the call court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Ead, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for appearing on our Zoom platform for today's oral arguments at the Court of Appeals. I want to remind you that despite the fact we are appearing by Zoom, that the rules of procedure do remain in place for the court. Each of you will have 15 minutes to state your case in chief. An additional 5 minutes will be reserved to appellate counsel if you choose to use that for a rebuttal. Another reminder, please pay attention to the time clock. It's not that large on my screen. There it is. It's better now. So that you'll be aware when your time has run down. Also, please state your name and indicate which party you are speaking on behalf of for our recording purposes. I'll ask our marshal to call the first case.
Case number A230632, in the matter of the welfare of the children of HMW, ATL, and GWA.
Ms. Sinsala, when you're ready, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Angela Sinsala, and I represent the appellant in this matter, HMW, who is the mother in this matter. And as the court is aware, mother's rights to her two children were terminated by the trial court. However, the trial court's findings were clearly erroneous and not supported by the totality of the evidence. In fact, the trial court's findings lacked clear and specific findings that address each of the statutory bases for termination. Before I proceed, I would also, I apologize, I forgot to ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttals, if it's possible to still do that.
Yeah, you will have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I do have a question for you at this point.
Yes.
In reading your briefing and looking over the file, it appears that you're raising issue that all four of the bases for the court's termination were not met. Obviously, we only need to find one basis to support a termination. How do you find it lacking that the court determined that the children were neglected in foster care? Because that's a matter of looking at the number of days they were gone and out. And I'm trying to follow your argument and give me a reason to support you in your contest of that.
Certainly, Your Honor, and the appellant concedes that only one statutory basis is required to be proven. Regarding the basis of neglected in foster care, I will concede that that is the weakest appellate argument that that the appellant has. But I think that the response to that is that it's not just in foster care, it's also neglected. And my response to that would be that in order to be considered neglected in foster care, appellant would have had to have been not actively working her case plan. If in fact the intent of the legislature is that any child who continues in foster care, essentially to the time of the timelines, is automatically considered neglected, then there would ultimately be no reason to even have a trial in these matters. The fact that the child continued to be in foster care, again, doesn't mean that mother wasn't actively working reunification and actively working towards having the children placed back in her home.
Counsel, let me just ask you about that. I think you make a strong point about actively working her case plan. The district court obviously found to the contrary, made several findings about with respect to all of the aspects of her case plan. What is your strongest argument that would compel us to conclude that, in fact, the district court got it wrong and that your client was actively working her case plan?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the appellant's strongest argument is the fact that the case plan was substantially complied with. And I think the evidence, and particularly the testimony at trial, really supports that. The court's findings don't focus, in appellant's opinion, on the evidence that was actually provided at trial. And looking at the requirement, looking at the fact that the petitioning party, that the agency's burden was to prove not only consistent pattern of specific conduct, but also that that conduct continued at the time of trial. And I think that at the time of the trial was largely ignored by the trial court. Also, that it would be conduct that would appear to continue for prolonged and indefinite period of time.
And in that regard, counsel, it seems to me there that the past is some indication of the future, right? And it, as I review this record, mother's persistent problem, you know, dating back, I think, till the 2014 or an earlier time, has been remaining abstinent from mood-altering substances, and that her use of mood-altering substances has led to the children's neglect. I'm struggling with the fact that she's still using mood-altering substances at the time of this trial. Why isn't that a critical point and supportive of the district court's conclusion?
I understand the court's concern, Your Honor's concern. However, I would respectfully disagree with the summation that mother's still using mood-altering substances. And this is a very interesting particular set of circumstances or facts in this, particularly in this state at this time. Mother did admit that she was using THC, that she was using marijuana, but marijuana use was not the reason that these children were removed from the home. These children were removed, and ultimately this case turned on mother's methamphetamine use. And it was very much the methamphetamine use that affected mother's ability to parent. And I think we need to look at, and the court has repeatedly said, that you need to look at the nexus between the parent's ability to parent and the behavior. So if mother's THC use or mother's marijuana use did not have any provable effect on her ability to parent, the fact that she was using THC in and of itself, when she had been abstaining for months from methamphetamine use, is not enough.
But if your argument, counsel, if your argument is that she's complying with her case plan for purposes of defeating the statutory ground of being neglected, excuse me, and in foster care, then shouldn't your client have objected to the broad language of the case plan that, as Judge Berkman said, includes abstaining from the use of any mood-altering substances rather than just abstaining from methamphetamine?
Certainly, I understand your point, Your Honor, and I think that that's in dispute, whether or not she agreed to the case plan. I believe there was discussion with her case manager regarding the use that he was concerned about really being focused on methamphetamine use. And then I think coupled with the fact that the legislature has since legalized the use essentially of marijuana.
Let me ask you about that though, because you're asking us to look at the conditions as they existed at the time of trial, and THC was unlawful at the time that this, in the state of Minnesota, at the time that this, this trial occurred. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It was unlawful at that time. But I also think it's important to focus on the fact that that we're looking at substantial compliance with the case plan. And that's what my argument is, that the appellant was substantially compliant with the case plan. In other words, looking at the most important pieces of the case plan. And so to focus on the marijuana usage of mom 4 months or 5 months before the state legislature made it legal, I think is taking us away from really what was most important in that case. And that is mom's ability to parent at the time of trial, mom's use or abstention of use of methamphetamine, which was really the problematic controlled substance in her life and the one that affected her ability to parent. And also looking at mom's stability. And I think it's concerning and problematic that, for example, the court finds that mom did not have a stable housing for herself and for the children for the foreseeable future. That's a finding that the trial court specifically made in its findings and order. However, the agency's own witness, who was the caseworker in this matter, specifically testified at trial that mother did have safe and sober housing available for both her and her children, and that it was for the foreseeable future, and in fact that he felt that it constituted completion or compliance of that particular element of the case plan.
But we also know that in fact it wasn't sober housing, that marijuana was being distributed throughout the home, that mother was using it, and presumably other residents were using it. And getting back to marijuana, the fact that it's legal, what difference does that make? It is a mood-altering chemical, right?
Yes, Your Honor, as is nicotine and caffeine, to be quite frank. But ultimately, it is a mood-altering substance. And again, there was no evidence presented at any point during the entirety of the trial that the use of that mood-altering substance by mother had any effect on her parenting. And I think that I would just continue to go back to that point, and I think that's an important point.
Isn't a bigger problem that if we accept what you're saying about marijuana as not being mother's drug of choice and not the issue that brought the children before the court, isn't the bigger problem a lack of demonstration that she would be able to remain sober in the community in an unstructured environment? And if we look at the fact that even in a structured environment like the sober living house, she's using what at the time was an illegal substance, marijuana. What's your response to that in terms of the district court's focus on the lack of demonstration of sobriety in the community outside of structure?
I would again point to what effect that had on mother and ultimately her ability to parent and to provide for her children. While she was admittedly continuing to use marijuana, she was also working full time. She had maintained stable employment for a number of months. She was living in what was considered by the treatment center to be sober living. And I think it's important to note that there was testimony that particular house that she was living in was not the same house that she would be living in if and when her children were returned to her. That there was, in fact, separate family sober living, which was a completely different house, but within the same agency or the same entity that mother qualified for, and that it was testified that, in fact, that housing was available to mother. And so this house that she was in was not the house that she would continue to be in once the children were placed back in her care. Or even if she were to be able to start having regular visitations with the children in that home. In addition to the fact that she was maintaining sobriety from methamphetamine, and maintaining consistent employment, again, she had housing plans that would allow her to live free of any concern from eviction for a period of up to 2 years from the date of trial. She also had been participating very actively in intensive treatment, intensive outpatient treatment.
And but didn't the Rule 25, the chemical dependency evaluation she complete at Pine Manor, recommend inpatient? And the case plan called for her to complete a chemical dependency evaluation and follow all recommendations. And mother didn't go to inpatient. She refused to do that. She instead chose to go to the intensive outpatient. What's your response to that?
Yes. And initially, the Rule 25 recommended outpatient, if I recall correctly. But ultimately, at some point, mother decided that she, on her own choice, wanted to try inpatient. And so because she needed that inpatient recommendation in order to get into the inpatient treatment, that ultimately, at her own request, was changed to an inpatient recommendation. She did, and just to clarify, mother did in fact go to inpatient treatment at Pine Manor. I agree that it was short-lived, but I think it's important to know that there were significant concerns at Pine Manor that had to do with the ability for mother to really be able to survive there. Mother testified that she was in a situation where it wasn't that she was that she, because there were only two other females inpatient at the time that she was there, and because females had to move about the common areas with another female And those other two females were essentially moving about the common area with themselves. She literally didn't have the ability to leave her room, even for eating and even for other purposes, because she was a sole female and was in violation of the rules by walking around the common areas. Nothing, no evidence was presented that mother ultimately was sexually inappropriate or any other sort of engaged in any other sort of inappropriate behavior, other than that she was literally moving in the common areas without being accompanied by another female, because she had very limited and essentially unavailable options. And because of the way she was being treated, she then chose to leave that treatment, but also proactively looked for essentially a replacement treatment, which is what she ultimately found in Evergreen, and ultimately was very successful to her. And so I think mother's own understanding of her own needs and her own what was in her best interest and what she needed in order to successfully complete treatment, she was very keenly aware of this. And ultimately, I think it's worth the court noting that she really herself went above and beyond to find the right place for her without a whole lot of help from the county. In fact, there were times she was reaching out to the county for assistance with placement and just wasn't getting the level of assistance that she felt that she deserved. I do think it's noteworthy. I see that my time is almost up. I think it's noteworthy that the primary social worker for the agency did testify during the trial that in fact, he thinks that the county probably could have done more to help mother. And I think that's a huge point in this particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sansawa. We'll turn then to respondent counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Katie Scher. I'm an assistant county attorney in Otter Tail County, and I'm the respondent attorney in this case. I think it's important. I'm kind of going to start where Ms. Sansawa left off. I think it's very important point to make that Ms. Sansawa indicated that HMW did what she felt was in the best interest of her. And that is a continuing theme throughout the entirety of this case. The district court even made a finding concerning this and summed it up best in finding that she did what she wanted to do instead of what was necessary for the best interest of the children in this case.
Can I ask you, you said you were going to pick up where Mother's sure. Counsel left off. Could I ask you to respond to the last statement that Mother's lawyer made? And that is that the social worker who was involved with this family testified the county didn't do all it could have and could have done more for Mother. How do you respond to that?
I don't think it's an accurate summation to say that the county didn't do their job in this case. What I do know from our agency is that we're always willing to do more, particularly the child protection worker in this case is always willing to do more. He did reach out to Mother several times and ask if she needed assistance with finding inpatient treatment. He offered several different agencies and said, what about this one? What about this one? In fact, he offered places in St. Cloud and in Moorhead, which are relatively a lot closer to the Fergus Falls and where she would have been able to do parenting time with her children. And Mother declined, saying they were too far away. And instead, she elected to choose Evergreen, which was a facility known to support the use of marijuana and was sober living, not inpatient, on her own accord, because Mother felt that that was what was in her best interest, not what was in the best interest of the children. As Judge Eady did point out, she never did complete inpatient treatment. Whatever Mother may have requested as far as inpatient treatment, from the very beginning of the case, the agency was saying, are you sure? Are you sure you don't want an updated Rule 25? But we think that an updated Rule 25 is necessary in this case. When she relapsed in July, when she relapsed in August, when she relapsed in September and November, each time the agency said, are you sure? We think you need an updated Rule 25. And Mother continuously said no.
Let me ask you about the Rule 25 issue, because one of the points that's noted is that a Rule 25 from Evergreen was never produced. Did the social worker have signed releases from Mother to obtain a chemical health assessment from the facility? I didn't see you argue that she refused to sign releases.
The testimony does provide that the social worker had reached out to Evergreen and Evergreen was not supplying that to the social worker.
Is that because the social worker didn't have a release, or because mother had rescinded any release and was actively preventing? And what is the evidence that was before the district court?
I will say it's unclear. The social worker did have a release at one time and was getting records at one time, and then it stopped. And so the assumption would be, as has happened in other cases, that that release was rescinded. Mother had done that in other times in this case, including with Someplace Safe, with the Parenting Time Center, rescinding the release of information and essentially stopping parenting time. It also happened with getting a release of information in order to get the Rule 25 that was allegedly completed at Lakeland Mental Health Center.
But the social worker did get an assessment from Pine Manor. That's how we know, right, that the recommendation was inpatient.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about your counterpart's argument as to substantial compliance. Why didn't the district court get this wrong on the issue of substantial compliance with the case plan and whether or not the children were truly neglected and in foster care? I mean, we have a mother here who, it seems undisputed, was no longer using the substance that brought the children before the court and was one of the biggest issues driving the neglect to begin with. So why didn't the district court get that wrong?
Well, I'll respond to that in two different ways. One, the appellant would like you believe that was the only reason that these children were removed from the home, was the methamphetamine use. But there was more than that. There was a nexus. It was mother's continual abandonment of the children, leaving them without a way to contact her, without financial resources, without an ability for the caregiver to enroll them in school, which caused them to miss school. It was all of these things that were based in mother's chemical dependency use, but also based in the decisions where she did not prioritize the children. She prioritized what she wanted to do. She also essentially left them homeless. She didn't have a place to be. And that in and out of mother and the children's lives was significantly detrimental to them and was provided through the testimony of the social worker and through their therapist.
At the time of the trial, she had this, I think that's what counsel's point is that she had this ability to live for 2 years. And counsel's saying it wouldn't necessarily be in the same home with the marijuana that she was residing, but she had this ability to house the children for 2 years. Why isn't that something that the district court should have weighted more heavily?
Well, and that's my second part, Your Honor, is that the other thing that appellant would like you to believe in this case is that only the credibility determinations of the district court are flawed. If you look at the findings of the district court specifically found that the agency's testimony and the testimony of the guardian ad litem was credible. No such findings were made about appellant or appellant's witness, her treatment provider. The court did not make any findings that they were credible. And the testimony that HMW would have this housing available for 2 years, that was only through her and through her witness herself. She had not implemented it. She also provided other plans. She said she could rent a house from her employer, that she had applied for HRA assistance in Ramsey County, but hadn't heard back, as she had just done that, I think, the Friday before trial. And so while she had all of these great plans, none of them were being implemented. She did not have a firm plan that, yes, I can do this. Secondly, I think it's speculative to say that this other house was going to be better than the house she was in. She would have other people living there, specifically another woman and their children. That's what the family housing was described as. But the testimony was clear that marijuana use was rampant, and providing marijuana to other people, other clients in this program was happening in this house. Who's not to say that it's not going to happen in this other house as well? And the district court hit on that and said, one, she doesn't have a firm plan. And two, she finds it appropriate to bring her children to a place where they're actively using THC.
And what is the specific risk of harm, in your view, to the children by mother's THC use?
I think it's pretty clear throughout this case that it's mother's chemical dependency and the choices that she makes while using substances that has been detrimental to the children. She doesn't make good decisions. She makes decisions based on her best interest and not the best interest of the children. I think it's also important to note that Pine Manor did diagnosed her with severe methamphetamine addiction, but also diagnosed her with severe cannabis use. Appellant argues that, you know, THC is like nicotine and caffeine, and that they're all substances that can be addictive. So is alcohol. And when there's significant alcohol use, those have been the basis of child protection cases. Because when people are encompassed in their addiction, they're not making appropriate decisions. And that's what led to this case. That mother was not making appropriate decisions. But there's other parts of the case plan, not just the chemical dependency that mother wasn't complying with. I mean, not only was she continuing to be positive, I mean, she was positive in May, positive in July, positive in August, September, October, November, positive in each of these months with very short periods of sobriety. I mean, there's even a short period of sobriety between the original Grant County case and the Otterdail County case of approximately 8 months. That's more than her sobriety at the time of trial. I mean, theoretically, the kids were returned to her and she was sober at the time, but she isn't able to maintain her sobriety. She also did not complete the parental capacity assessment, despite the fact that the agency went over and above in setting up three different appointments for her with Lakeland Mental Health. She failed to appear for each one of those and then went and found a separate provider when Lakeland was no longer willing to even be a referral. She didn't comply with the second provider. At the time of trial, she had not complied with returning the paperwork that needed to be done, and that assessment couldn't be completed. Not only that she was very sporadic in her visitation. I mean, even if you look solely at the testimony of HMW, she admitted all of these things. She admitted she hadn't been sober. She admitted she had continued use. She admitted that her visitation with her children had been extremely sporadic up until she entered Evergreen, and that even at the time of trial, she'd only had a few supervised visits with the children. She had never moved to unsupervised visitation with the children or even come close to a trial home visit. She admitted getting new felony criminal charges during the child protection case. She admitted that the agency had attempted to help her with inpatient treatment, and she declined. She declined their help. Mother was very set on doing things her own way and ignoring the help that the agency was offering. So,
well, but mother's decision to go to Evergreen, I mean, coincided with abstinence from meth, which was the problematic controlled substance that led to these children's removals, I guess, back in 2020 and again in 2022. I mean, isn't that significant?
I think it's significant that her tests were coming up clean and that she was not using methamphetamine. But I think that's what the court was getting at. And I mean, this court is aware that the palpably unfit is the hardest, arguably the hardest ground on which to terminate parental rights. And yet the district court found it because of this constant pattern of mother getting sober, relapsing, getting sober, relapsing. I mean, we saw it half a dozen times in this case in itself. But we also saw that pattern from the prior cases in Becker County and in Grant County, that mother struggled with her sobriety. And instead of tackling this issue head on, even from the very beginning, mother did it her own way. She went to outpatient treatment. She was not going to do inpatient. At that time, it was because she didn't want to leave her dog. I mean, mother made excuse after excuse as to why she was not going to inpatient. And when she did go to inpatient, when she finally went to meet Pine Manor, she lasted 3 days. She admitted that she hadn't given Pine Manor a chance to rectify the problems that she was asserting were the reason she left. 3 days. That's how long she ended up in inpatient treatment. She never did go back. She never did work with the agency again to get into another inpatient treatment. In fact, she just said, nope, this is what I'm going to do. She was dead set on outpatient treatment. And she admitted at the time of trial that, no, it was sober living. She had not complied with that inpatient treatment recommendation. I think even though this court could rely on HMW's testimony to support the findings of the district court, I mean, that's not what the role of this court is. The court allows the district court to make those credibility determinations. And when the record reasonably supports the district court's findings, it doesn't matter if there's support any other way for different findings. So even if this court were just to look at the testimony of HMW and her witness, this court can still find that there is support for each and every one of the termination of parental rights statutory grounds that were found. Appellant's not been able to demonstrate that the district court abused their discretion in terminating her rights on each of these four separate grounds. And on those bases, her appeal should be denied by this court. I don't have anything else for the court unless there's any other questions.
It appears not, Ms. Scher. Thank you.
Thank you.
Back to appellant counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Scher states repeatedly that the credibility, the court's determination of credibility is really key here. And I think it's important to note, as Ms. Scher noted, that the court did find the social worker, the primary social worker in the case, Mr. Larson's testimony, to be credible. And I think it's also very important to note that there are some very important things regarding the case plan that Mr. Larson testified about that the court ultimately sort of ignored and didn't include in its findings. And that is that mom had substantially complied with her case plan, ultimately. Mr. Larson did testify that he felt that her sobriety or abstinence from methamphetamine constituted ultimately compliance with the case plan. He himself did not testify, and in fact, in his testimony, he did not believe that her ongoing marijuana use ultimately resulted in her not being considered compliant with the.
Didn't he support termination? Didn't the social worker testify in support of termination?
He did support termination.
And isn't the problem that, I mean, like you said in your opening remarks, we have to look at the totality of the evidence. So as much progress as mother made, which is commendable, don't we have to consider what counsel was arguing is the history of the case and the brief periods of sobriety and all of that in addition to how she was doing at the time of trial?
Yes, Your Honor, that does need to be considered. And it was heavily considered by the court, but I think it was considered to the exclusion of how mom was really doing at the time of trial. And it does need to be a balance. We need to look at that history, but most importantly and paramount is how mom is doing at the time of trial, coupled with the foreseeable future and whether or not there's a support that there's belief that mom would be unable to parent her children within the foreseeable future. And I do not believe that that was proven by the petitioner at trial. In fact, again, the caseworker's own testimony ultimately supports that mom substantially complied with her case plan, and yet he makes the ultimate decision that says, but he's in support of termination. And this is exactly the basis of this appeal. It didn't seem to make sense that the caseworker's testimony said she did have safe and sober housing. She did substantially comply with the requirement that she remain sober, which he felt meant sobriety from methamphetamine was really the ultimate and most important sobriety that was at issue in this case. She did have stable employment at the time of trial. She did have a plan moving forward. She had, in fact, been successful in going to treatment, and this was an intensive outpatient treatment with sober living. He did, in fact, testify that she was compliant with testing. He did, in fact, testify that she was compliant with her requirement to do a CD evaluation. And also regarding following those rules and recommendations, again, that initial CD evaluation requirement or recommendation was for outpatient treatment. The county didn't necessarily like that recommendation, but that's what it was for. And that is ultimately what she completed was intensive outpatient treatment. The agency did testify that there was no evidence that she had allowed the children to be around any safe, unsafe, or people who were not sober. As far as the
I don't even know if that's a finding that's important, is it? I mean, mother has only had unsupervised visits and only a handful of them, right?
That is correct. But I do think that it's noteworthy that there was that the social worker did testify also that he had not been to Mother's home at Evergreen. And in fact, she had been there for several months. His testimony was before any sort of trial home visit could happen or could occur, he would need to go down there and see the home. And yet he hadn't, at that point, she had been there for months and he had not even been there to see where she was living or to see the home. I also think that Ms. Scher mischaracterizes evidence when she says that there was evidence that marijuana was rampant at Evergreen. I do not think that that's a fair characterization of the evidence. There was not any evidence saying that it was rampant, nor was there evidence or testimony that the use was specifically in the home itself, or that the children, there was no reason to reasonably believe that the children would be exposed to any drug use at that safe and sober housing in Evergreen that Mother had secured for the future. It's concerning too that Ms. Scher states that it was essentially well known that Evergreen was a facility that allowed for THC use, and yet the county approved my client, the appellant, going to this treatment center. And so if ultimately the idea is she's going to be exposed to marijuana and that's going to negate any opportunity for her to be successful in getting her children back, and yet the county approved this placement, it makes no sense. I see that I'm out of time.
Your time has expired, but you can sum up.
Thank you. I would just sum, in summary, I would ask the court to overturn the trial court's termination of parental rights based on the fact that Mother did substantially comply with the case plan, that the most important thing, which was Mother's methamphetamine use, and that was when Mother made these poor parenting decisions, had been corrected at the time of trial. And again, that the social worker himself, who was found to be credible, testified as to Mother's substantial compliance. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. This is deemed to be an expedited matter that means a decision will be issued within the 45-day statutory timeframe. That does conclude this hearing. Thank you.